Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The world-renowned counterculture artist Banksy opened a theme park in England late last week. True to form, Banksy's version of Disneyland, named Dismal Land, a bemusement park, has all the hallmarks of the mysterious artist's political commentary on contemporary society. Complete with a dark and frightening castle, dead princesses, boats filled with migrants, and sulking employees, Dismal Land is a pitch-perfect subversion of theme park culture and capitalism. But in today's global economy, where commercialism permeates everything we do, Banksy's art seems rarer than ever. Industries clamoring for so-called creative work have blurred the lines between art, culture, and commerce so much that the spaces for political art seem smaller and smaller. My guest, Nato Thompson, has explored these themes in his new book, Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century. He's a writer and highly acclaimed art curator. He's chief curator at the public arts institution Creative Time and a curator at Mass MoCA. He's the editor of The Interventionists, a user's manual for the creative disruption of everyday life. Welcome to Uprising, Nato.
Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first let me ask you about the Banksy art project. It seemed so appropriate as I was getting ready, preparing for this interview and reading your book, that this burst out onto the scene, this highly creative and very, very political, massive art installation by one of the most well-known political artists of our time. What do you make of Dismal Land?
You know, it's so funny. I've never got my head around the Banksy thing in general, but it seems pretty cool. You know, I can't tell. I just don't know where he comes from. You know, there's a weird thing we have in this life. You know, like the artist Shepard Fairey, perhaps, with the Obey campaign. You know, there is a kind of line which is difficult to figure out, which is the critique of capital still can be fair game for capital. And so it's hard to know. You know, I think it is a bleak look at capitalism. And in some ways, I like that it has a popular kind of audience to it. So it seems pretty interesting in that way. And also taking pot shots at Disneyland is certainly fun. It looks kind of cool to go to.
How badly has corporate culture co-opted art today? I mean, how has it impacted our ability to see power dynamics between elites and the rest of us?
Well, I think, you know, part of the book I go into is this idea that there's almost a greenhouse emission that from cultural production. That is to say, the kind of uses of images, basically advertising, using the things we love against us. If you think in the 70s, you'd see about 500 images a day of advertising. Today, we see about 5,000. So just the aggregate of that over day after day after day and generations growing up like that, you begin to distrust the things you love, just visually. And I think that over time, we have shaped ourselves to both, you know, for example, activists. You know, you love the image of Che Guevara, but also Che Guevara was used by Taco Bell and turned into a chihuahua.
Yeah.
So, and I think that at times it erodes our sense of trust of all the things we love, from punk rock to music to video games to visual culture. It becomes very complicated.
Well, art has always been political. For as long as we've had artists, we've had artists who have used their work to comment on our social structures and our political institutions. But there have been heydays of political art and eras where very little has come out. You point out in your book one of these heydays was actually the 1990s, where American artists pioneered this idea of culture jamming. Magazines like Adbusters became very popular for their satires of corporate culture. But then when Bush came into power and the 9/11 attacks happened, there was actually surprisingly less political art. And I was surprised by that.
Sure. You know, it's wild. I mean, if you think back to the Bush era, there was a growing movement. It's called the Alt-Globalization Movement after the Battle of Seattle of 1999. Protest movements emerged. There was a lot of art and activism happening. And then when 9/11 happened, it got squashed really flagrantly in the United States. In that era since then, what we've seen, and I think everyone knows there's a secret battle happening, but I did a trip across the country from town to town in 2008 when Obama was elected. And the war, there was the Iraq war going on, but there was another war going on that everyone was really invested in, and that was the gentrification war, the war over re-urbanization of America. And a lot of artists and activists were very invested in trying to think through what that meant. In particular, as you can't go to any city in America, let alone the world, without people talking about it. But artists were confused by their living habits, literally gentrifying neighborhoods that they wanted to retain diversity in. And so that battle, which is a spatial urban battle, complicated things. And that was, in my opinion, that things changed a lot during that period.
And so we then have the post, almost, we're almost at the post-Obama age, of course. We're approaching the post-Obama age. And I'm wondering how you view what is happening today, because in the 1990s, not only was our exposure to advertising less than it is today, but the internet was less encompassing and less permeating of so many aspects of our lives. Today, every click that we place on our computers becomes fodder for marketing something to us that companies think we might want to buy. How does that impact our ability to have artistic expression that's political?
Well, I think one of the things we have to be very careful with, it's not just corporate culture. Capitalism's trickled into very individual levels. And basically, there's social networking, but in some ways people have become their own advertisers of the ultimate product, which is themselves, right? So, Facebook's both a way to socially get along with people, but also to perpetuate yourself as a job opportunity or as a culture maker. And so in some ways, we are in this peculiar situation of both growing sense of community, but also the capacity to leverage ourselves as commodities. And that produces both, Black Lives Matter, for example, is an incredible movement, very social networking geared, very of this period. But at the same time, there's an erosion of distrust as time goes on, of people wondering who's in it for what reason, interstitial fights break out, and solidarity, that term of just people uniting for a social cause, is very difficult in an age where social networking and capitalism are very bound up together. And I think that is very indicative of the moment we're in.
Well, it's tough, of course, being an artist and being a political activist these days. Specifically in art, there's less and less funding in the United States. It's harder and harder for artists to make a living as artists. So most turn to PR or graphic design, deploying their artistic talents to sell stuff. And they feel like they're forced into, Instagram is their pathway to possibly making money, where artists themselves might be, for example, paid to do sponsored ads because they've built up enough cachet and enough followers who like their art, that then that becomes the product.
Sure. It can easily become a cynical, depressing story if you go down that road too long. I certainly end up there. But I think it's, at the same time, the good news of art, I would say, is art at the early 20th century was certainly small groups of people painting and doing sculptures. And it wasn't the thing that it is in the 21st, which is, everyone has Instagram. Everyone's a photographer if you have a phone. So this, the skill sets of art are really a part of everyday life in a way. And so it's hard to kind of categorize just art. I think culture is the language we speak today. We speak through images and word. A lot of the things that advertising does, we naturally do. We understand performativity. We understand visual representation. A lot of these skills are just, young people, it's just what they do. And so the arts is a profoundly a form of speech in the world that we're in. And so, untangling the knot between when it's capitalism or what other forms of power, patriarchy, other forms of sexual oppression. There's all kinds of ways in which this stuff roots itself in. But I think at the end of the day, culture offers a profoundly emotional space to interrogate the world we live in today. And it's exciting.
And I want to get to that part of it, but to stay on the depressing aspect a little bit more, corporations have, of course, very gleefully appropriated the political art that we see. All you have to do is walk into, for example, an Urban Outfitters, and you'll see on T-shirts. In fact, Urban Outfitters recently even commissioned some very important artists to put the founders of the, or one of the, two of the women of, trans women of color, who started the Stonewall riots, on T-shirts. Now, to their credit, Urban Outfitters gave back a large portion of the sales to the artists, but still the artists put out this lengthy statement about their struggle that they went through on getting the images out versus selling out. And those are pretty common struggles I think artists face.
Oh my gosh, it's so painful. I mean, you can think to early Apple ads where they You know, they had the Think Different campaign, and they would have Gandhi on it. They'd have Martin Luther King on it. And, you know, there was an era in the mid-90s of just the co-optation of all 1950s, 60s radical culture as corporate imagery. Today, there's a kind of what's called capitalist realism, where artists feel like they've definitely just got to sell out because it's the only way. So you have bands that get famous, but of course they can't make money on music anymore. So the only way they really make money is literally being jingles behind like an Audi ad or something like that. And so, but that said, you know, I think like the important thing to bear in mind is that this catch-22 is germane to a lot of people. And it is a painful thing because you sell what you love as a weapon against people, is how I think of it. And it is totally depressing. And everybody does it too. It's not just artists, because of course, like Starbucks coffee, you think it's the most green, environmentally friendly thing in the world. BP oil, you know, they have these green campaigns, they have things called greenwashing. You know, so we're used to this catch 22 where, you know, we have the Gap Red campaign, where Gap clothing is fighting HIV AIDS in Africa, but simultaneously using sweatshop labor. So we're caught in this kind of confusing situation where everyone's helping the world while simultaneously destroying it.
But media literacy, because of internet culture, is also higher than ever. And so we're seeing through that more clearly now than before.
Well, I think that is the shining light in all this, is that I think people can see through these things, and we are becoming more well adapted to kind of catching the falseness of this. Trust, frankly speaking, trust is the glue behind meaning making in the world. And I think that capital really reduces trust. But simultaneously, that's why social networking is very powerful, because people increasingly don't trust power. They trust their friends. You know, that's where their trust is emerging from. And so they're really producing these networks of alternative meaning making. And I think the shining light of all of this is to produce networks of meaning, you know, whether it's visual culture or spatial culture, just ways to be together that resist the dominant giant power structures, CBS, MTV, you know, these kind of big makers of meaning that are in the world.
Nato, I'm you're an art curator, and I want to turn to how you navigate this world that we're in to showcase art that has real meaning. I want to ask you to especially tell us about Kara Walker's incredible sugar sculpture in New York that you curated. Very, you know, it was controversial. It was huge. It was powerful, and had so many different meanings. Can you tell us about the process that you went through in terms of this discussion that we're just having, the process that you went through to curate this piece?
Well, so Kara Walker is an artist based in Brooklyn, New York, and we got access to a space called Domino Sugar Factory, which is a giant space that was the old Domino refinery plant along the Brooklyn waterfront that was going to be torn down. And we asked Kara Walker if she wanted to do a project there. I curate for a place called Creative Time, where we commission large-scale projects in public space. It's free and accessible to everyone. In that case, you know, it was really, you know, Kara Walker is the artist. It was her vision, and she created a massive sculpture made of sugar of a African-American woman that was naked, kind of looking like a sphinx with a mammy scarf on her head and with exaggerated sexuality, and it became kind of a tourist attraction that garnered a lot of controversy. It was around trade. It was around the history of sugar and its exploitation. It was around the female black body. It was about kind of exploitative imagery. And then discussions over time emerged of, you know, who has the right to take a selfie with it? What's the appropriate way to take a selfie with it? And in this age of social networking in public space, the controversy really blew up online as it became people watching people in front of this very confusing public artwork, which I loved. And it was an incredible piece to talk about race and gender and sexuality and labor all in one public art go.
And in that sense, it seems as though this is the kind of art that is not only possible, but given that it generated conversation, seems quite appropriate for our day and age. Any last thoughts, particularly to artists who are listening and watching this interview about what it means to be an artist in the 21st century?
I think in this day and age, two things are very much important. One, I would say artists of the world and just citizens, go take over. You don't have to just take over or be a participant in government, but you can take over your workplace. You can take over the art institutions. You can, you know, think of the infrastructures in your life as places for democracy, not just government itself. That's one thing. The alternative to that, too, that I think is very important is if you feel locked out from those institutions, I strongly advise make your own institutions, create your own blogs, make your own spaces, produce community. We live in an age where you can legitimate your artistic production yourself with online networking and all this, and you do not need to go through the New York Times. You don't need to go through major television to produce a meaningful relationship with the world that is a little bit outside of capital. Not completely, but a little bit. And I think that that's extremely important, is to find ways of producing the world we want to be in, as opposed to waiting for the world that's out there to come to us.
Well, Nato Thompson, thank you so much for a very interesting conversation. And we'll post a link to your book, Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century, on our website, uprisingwithsonali.com. Thanks so much, Nato.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
This is Uprising, and our website is uprisingwithsonali.com, and you can find us as well on facebook.com/uprisingradio and on twitter.com/uprisingradio. We've tried to create our own community that is creative with the resources, the few and dwindling resources that we have. We'll be right back after this break.